While the 2016 U.S. presidential campaign was pitched on many fronts, there's little doubt that frustration over the state of the economy was one of its most defining characteristics. At a glance, it might be hard to understand. By most top-line measures, the U.S. economy is as robust as it has ever been. Unemployment is low, GDP growth has been consistent, and even manufacturing output is strong. But dig deeper and there are plenty of causes for concern. Several decades of stagnant middle-class wages have driven income inequality higher than ever, and economic mobility is falling. The American dream seems on the retreat. And if that weren't enough, innovations like the gig economy and automation are poised to introduce major shifts in the very nature of work in the 21st century. Hello and welcome to the Harvard Kennedy School PolicyCast. I'm your host, Matt Cadwallader, and if that feels like a lot to unpack, we've got a great group of guests this week to help do most of the heavy lifting. In the second of our three-part series of faculty roundtable discussions leading up to President Donald Trump's inauguration, we're joined by Dean Doug Elmendorf, who from 2009 to 2015 served as director of the Congressional Budget Office, Professor Bridget Madrian, a behavioral economist who's been focused on household savings and investment behavior, and Professor David Elwood, who stepped down recently as Dean of the Kennedy School and now heads up the Wiener Center for Social Policy, where he's set his sights on issues related to inequality. Welcome, everyone.
Thank you.
So the 2016 election, it's brought a lot of discussion about economics. Inequality certainly has been on the tips of a lot of people's tongues. But it's also been about culture. It's often been cited that the average salary of a Donald Trump primary voter was $72,000, well above the national median wage. Doug Elmendorf, as an economist, what's been your major takeaway from this election?
I think we have an economy that over the past few decades has been working very well for some people in our country and not very well for many others. And I think there is legitimate frustration about that, and I think concern by other people that even if things are okay for them now, they might not be so good in the future because they watch their friends and neighbors encounter various problems. And I think that economic frustration and concern is part of what is motivating a sense of the part of many Americans that they want change in the country. But I agree with you that a lot of what people are frustrated about beyond economic changes are also social changes.
Mm-hmm. Doug, can I ask you a question about this $70,000 figure and so forth? What's striking to me is that people talk about the $72,000 figure and then they consistently talk about Trump voters as white working class people. And so my question is, first of all, do you actually believe that? Do you think it's like different groups? Is this somebody that used to have a secure living or does but doesn't expect their kid? I mean, how do you, kids to make it, how do you think about that?
I'm not sure. My guess is that there are different sorts of people who are voting for Donald Trump for different sorts of reasons, just as there are different sorts of people voting for Hillary Clinton for different sorts of reasons. I think some of the people who are voting for Donald Trump want more conservative economic policies in the country. They view this as a way to enable the agenda of Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell and their colleagues in the Congress to move ahead. And I think Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell view this as a way to move their agenda ahead. So I think part of Donald Trump's support comes from more traditional economic conservatives. I think part comes from people who are worried about what has happened to them or could happen to them. And if you look at the states that went for Donald Trump in a surprising way, you look at states like Pennsylvania and Ohio and Michigan, where we know there has been a hollowing out of their economies over the past several decades. And that hollowing out of their economies has had real social consequences. So the opioid epidemic, as an example, where people are really hurting. And I think that there are a number of causes of that epidemic, but part of that is people who have lost jobs and don't have the focus in their lives that a successful career can bring, and they turn to other things.
Yeah, I think that's actually a pretty sensible way to think about it. And I actually think it's a mixture of people. And so I think the $72,000 figure is kind of uninteresting and misleading. And I agree with you, particularly where there were the surprises. Those are places overall where it really does feel like it's not only that people are struggling, their kids are struggling. And it's not clear whether they,
people work hard and their kids are supposed to do better. And that sense of the American dream, particularly in the kind of so-called Rust Belt or Midwestern states and so forth, I think is really being challenged. For a very long time, the median wages of full-time male workers have been pretty flat, depending on how you adjust for inflation. And it's far from clear that their kids will do better than they will, again, adjusted for inflation. So I think there's a lot of real frustration there, as I say, particularly in the surprising states. And I think there's some other elements, of course, that are kind of the country's very narrowly divided, you know, closely divided between Republican and Democrat anyway. So the interesting question is, why did some states flip that, you know, went for Obama before? And to me, these economic explanations are really quite potent. I care a lot about mobility from poverty and stuff, but what is very, very clear, you go to certain regions and it just, you know, it doesn't feel like there's any mobility from anything.
You were deeply involved with welfare reform in the 1990s in the Clinton administration. Obviously, through all this economic inequality talk, we've been talking about raising the middle class. Mm-hmm. But it seems like the talk about how this is affecting the poor has been a secondary issue almost.
Well, I think not losing the middle class entirely, but certainly the hollowing out that Doug was talking about is very real. And it's a lot harder for people in the lower rungs to get to the upper rungs if the upper rungs are falling or don't exist. But that said, I guess I wouldn't entirely agree with your characterization. I'm really quite struck by how many people are focused on mobility. Words like mobility are used by Paul Ryan all the time, heavy focus and so forth. There's plenty of debate about the different strategies to be used and the like. I myself am leading a group called the Partnership for Mobility from Poverty that's being sponsored by the Gates Foundation. And that activity is really striking how many people are really, really quite focused on this question. And I think the key here is I think there's much less interest in, you know, traditional highly targeted benefits to the poor. But there's a lot more interest in various strategies that might help people get ahead, find a way to work and move forward.
Bridget Madrian, much of the middle class as we know it has been built on decades and decades of investment from people, you know, investing in their houses, investing in 401ks, all of this type of thing. As wages have stagnated, have we seen people change the way they approach savings? And is that helping them stay perhaps in a middle class mindset where they might not have had the opportunity before?
So I think the biggest change we've seen is a change in social responsibility for individuals versus personal responsibility. So if you looked, for example, at how we provide income for the elderly in retirement 30 or 40 years ago, it would have come primarily from Social Security and also from private pensions that are a guaranteed benefit provided by an individual's former employer. And over the past 30 or 40 years, that system has completely changed. So Social Security is still an important source of income, but of course, it's got serious fiscal challenges that need to be addressed going forward. And we've basically replaced private employer pensions for individuals in the private sector, not in the public sector, with 401k plans where the outcome is really determined by how much you save and do you make good investment choices or not. So it's a riskier proposition for individuals. And one key element of risk is that only about half of the workforce is participating in an employer-sponsored savings plan. And the other half predominantly doesn't even have access to an employer-sponsored savings plan. So not only are we seeing inequality in current wages, we're seeing inequality in kind of the ability and accumulation of wealth for retirement that's going to, you know, persist, you know, for, you know, decades mm-hmm. going forward. And you know, we'll have to see what happens. But you know, it's not inconceivable that this could lead to dramatically you know, more inequality amongst the elderly, where you have some elderly who are really well off because they were in good paying jobs with benefits and saved for retirement, and then you have this whole other segment that really didn't accumulate anything and are heavily reliant on Social Security. But Social Security in the U.S. is much less generous than it is in some of some other of our developed country counterparts.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think Bridget's point is very important, because we have a society where we've provided a certain amount of support for people through their private employers, and that really is changing. And mm-hmm. I don't think we've thought through all the things that we need to do as a society to help people who don't get pensions through their employers, who don't get health insurance through their employers.
That's the Uber economy, right?
The Uber economy, mm-hmm. But it's not just the particular high-tech, cool new things we see. There's a lot of more basic outsourcing by firms, where it might have been several decades ago the firm's custodians and cafeteria workers worked for the large firm mm-hmm. and received benefits that the firm had created for its professional as well as its non-professional employees. And there are rules the IRS enforces about the tax deductibility of some expenses, where you have to make sure you're providing them for all of your employees. You can't just have a plan that just benefits the slice of your employees. But what firms have done is now more and more of those lower-skilled, less well-paid jobs have been outsourced. So the large firm now pays a small firm, contracts with a small firm, to provide the dining services or to provide the custodial services. Mm-hmm. And that small firm, composed almost entirely of low-wage workers, doesn't have a pension plan, doesn't have health insurance, doesn't have various other features. And I think that's part of the widening of income in that.
I really think this is critical also. That recent evidence also shows, and this is consistent with what you're saying, Doug, that the inequality within firms has narrowed considerably. That's because no longer are there lower paid workers. And it also means that, you know, job ladders, which, you know, somebody notices you're doing a great job and maybe a lower skill job and you move up. People don't start in the mailroom anymore. There isn't a mailroom. And so that kind of mobility has been lost as well. And so I think, especially when you don't have these links to employers, by the way, some people used to get through unions as well, which are yes. pretty much, you know, except in a very few industries, especially government, collapsing. In some respects, I just think that it's benefits, it's everything, but it's not just the money, it's the mobility, it's the sense of a future. And also, by the way, it's not that your kid can work in the steel mills after you. And so you put all those pieces together, a changing economy, a place where people move from job to job with really high regularity, and yet we don't have a system that people are comfortable with or use or whatever that creates mobile pensions or other kinds of things. And you can see the level of frustration. And quite honestly, people have not been paying attention, and it's not surprising that people feel pretty frustrated.
There's a fair amount of uncertainty about what Donald Trump's specific policy prescriptions will be when he does take office. But with Republicans in control of the House and the Senate for years now, we do know many of the things that they've wanted to pass for a long time. One of those things is entitlement reform. You touched on the importance of just the thinking about private versus social savings. What does that mean for us as we approach a potential political fight about entitlement reform? How should we be thinking about this?
That's a great question. And we don't have a lot of specifics from at least the presidential campaign on what Trump's priorities are there. When he was asked about Social Security, which is the biggest entitlement program and in serious fiscal difficulties for the long run, he gave a very short answer that he wanted to cut taxes and not cut benefits. And the math from that does not add up. The only way to make Social Security fiscally sustainable going forward is through a combination of cutting benefits, increasing taxes, and probably delaying the retirement age a little bit. And if you do all three of those, you can do them in small measure. And if you do them sooner, you can do them in a smaller measure. But if you procrastinate, it's going to require bigger cuts. And if you put your head in the sand or you, you know, deny the math, it's not going to work out. I think an important thing to note in this debate is that when we talk about cutting benefits, what's the benchmark? What's the baseline for thinking about what a benefit cut would look like? And the really key thing to note is that under the current system, if changes are not made, in 2034, everyone will get a 23% cut in their benefits. And that will happen because under current law, when 2034 comes and the Social Security Trust Fund is exhausted, the Social Security Administration can only pay out benefits that are equal to the taxes that are coming in. The taxes that are coming in are going to be 23% lower under current projections than the benefits that have been promised. Mm-hmm. So individuals who have been promised a certain benefit will be getting a 23% benefit cut. Mm-hmm. If we reform the system today, we can do it in such a way where the benefit cut that I talked about is a cut relative to promised benefits, but it's an increase over the benefits that would actually be delivered if we push this off, don't do anything, and get the 23% benefit cut that will happen in the mid-2030s.
Doug Elmendorf, obviously you oversaw the scoring of some of these, some of the Republican proposals over the last few years. What can we expect to see?
I think it's very unclear what sort of entitlement reform Republicans will actually pursue in the specifics. You're right that they talk about doing entitlement reform, but in fact, the Republican-led House has, in the past 6 years, moved no legislation that would significantly cut entitlements except for repeal of the Affordable Care Act. And even the Affordable Care Act, the subsidies for lower middle-income people in the Affordable Care Act are only 10% of the total subsidies for health insurance that the federal government provides. So that particular piece of health benefits, the Republicans clearly have been opposed to. But they've moved no other legislation that would significantly cut benefits. And I think that's because, although in the abstract, cutting entitlement benefits sounds good to a lot of people, in the specifics, it gets much harder. And part of this is the point that Bridget made. The largest program is Social Security, mm-hmm. which is pretty popular for most people. Mm-hmm. Analysts talk about ways to cut it back. Most voters don't. The next biggest entitlement program is Medicare. It's pretty popular with most people. And analysts develop ways to cut it back, and I support some. But that's not a real political winner, as I think Donald Trump correctly understood when he ran. And the programs for lower-income people, the expensive ones are really in health care. The non-health means-tested benefits are not a particularly large or growing share of GDP. Mm-hmm. So the money, both today and in the growth over time, is in benefits for older Americans, largely because so many more Americans will be eligible for Social Security and Medicare. And those programs have a lot of political popularity. So how much Republicans will actually decide to cut when you get down to specifics and have to face voters and explain why you're cutting certain things, I think is very unclear.
And Florida was a key state in this last election. So not clear that that's the state whose voters you want to alienate going forward.
But so if we have a world here where it's very hard to come up with substantial budget cuts that are credible, by the way, just as an aside, in low-income policies, there are things they want to change about entitlements. For example, SNAP, which used to be called food stamps. People talk about block granting it and sending it to the states, and maybe in the long run that's...
Can you define block grant?
Oh, I'm sorry. Currently, that's an entitlement in this case means there's pretty much a uniform set of benefits across the country, uniform standard and so forth. In the past, another program, now called TANF, formerly called AFTC for single parents, was given to the states. They each got a block grant equal to the amount they used to be getting from the federal government for the people in their state. The consequences were initially promising, but in the last recession, disastrous, because the money, which supposedly was for low-income parents, a lot of it got diverted to other points. But the larger point I want to focus on, and I personally think our one program that is about let's make sure nobody goes hungry in America doesn't feel like one that we'd like to sort of say, well, unless you're in Mississippi or in Minnesota, whatever happens. What I would say, though, what I'm interested from both of you, though, is it feels to me like the kind of proposals that are coming out are huge tax cuts, particularly at the top. I don't, you know, where things will actually stand. And no credible budget cuts. So doesn't what does that do in the short run? Is that a train wreck? I mean, how do I think about this? And in the short run, are we going to, like, have a strong economy? And then what happens? Just how do you think about that?
I think the political challenge for Republicans is that they talk about the importance of reducing federal debt, in fact, balancing the budget.
Yeah.
But even trying to keep debt from rising relative to the size of the economy requires some net reduction in deficits relative to what will happen under current law. And I think that's very hard to accomplish and very hard to even pretend you accomplish. I mean, a standard budget deal has a certain number of gimmicks that probably won't come to pass. But at least it looks good. I think to try to find a set of budget proposals that would cut taxes by some trillions of dollars and even pretends to look good will be very difficult because, you know, we already have caps on discretionary spending that are lower on defense spending, certainly, than Republicans support, and are lower on non-defense spending for many individual Republicans who support particular programs, even if in general they want to cut government spending. We have caps on discretionary spending. We have the big benefit programs for older Americans that are very widely supported. We have programs for lower income Americans where you can make some cuts. But even then, I was at I participated in a panel at the American Enterprise Institute over the summer. They had a proposal for changes in benefit programs. But the people who focused on the non-health means-tested programs didn't have big changes to propose. In dollar terms, they had lots of very interesting sorts of changes in the way the programs work. But they were explicit that this might save some money, it might cost some money. They were not big dollar savings. And this was from AEI, so this was not just a sort of liberal take. This was a conservative take. I think it's very hard to find big money there. So my guess is that there will be smaller cuts in taxes than are proposed, and then a certain amount, and then some real cuts in spending, and then some pretend cuts in spending that will at least look superficially like it's not making the deficit worse.
It'll be fun to watch the votes on the debt ceiling going forward. Who has
yes.
to vote what?
Yes.
Another major theme of the election on both sides, first with the Bernie Sanders supporters, eventually Hillary Clinton, and of course Donald Trump, was a rejection of free trade agreements like the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Now that President Trump will be coming in to a Republican-led Congress, obviously Republicans have traditionally been very pro-free trade, but that seems to be a fundamental disconnect with the White House.
Yes.
I think this comes back to the question you started out with. So I think, you know, free trade is something that Republicans have traditionally supported. And, you know, all three of us here are economists by training. And when we teach economics classes, one concept we talk about is efficiency. And free trade is usually billed as something that is efficient in the sense that it allows us to expand economic output at lower cost. If we're, you know, if China can produce something at a lower cost than we can, it makes sense to produce something in China where it's cheap to produce it, and we produce other things where we're better suited, and then we trade and everyone's better off. Now, when you teach that in class, you recognize that there will be winners and losers, and the idea is, well, if we can expand the size of the pie, in theory, we can make the losers better off through redistributive programs. And I think some of the pushback, some of the kind of Trump supporters who Reagan Democrats who have people who may have supported, you know, Democratic administrations in the past, but are willing to be somewhat flexible, that some of their frustration is we are the people who lost out from these free trade deals, and there was no attempt to do things that would help us reap the benefits from free trade that are accruing to the economy as a whole.
David Elwood, was free trade really the source of the problem here? Or was this, do you think this was a fundamental, people just didn't understand that, you know, the benefits were there, they just...
I don't think there's any doubt that trade plays some role. If what you do can be done more cheaply somewhere else, that's not good for you in the near term. Mm-hmm. And I really agree with Bridget and Doug in sort of saying, you know, the people are sort of saying, I knew there were going to be winners and losers, but how come I always lose and you always win? Having said that, I think the much larger set of forces at work here are not the international ones, except in the sense that technology and a variety of other things. And I think one of the great challenges here is it's pretty hard to resist. You can try and close borders and so forth, but it doesn't fundamentally solve your problem because you then make the pie smaller, and then what are you going to do? Mm-hmm. And so I think what you have to do is figure out strategies whereby people can compete and be much more successful in this kind of world. I think there are many other things you can do to try and create a more of a strategy for job ladders, more ways in which people can move forward. But I don't think the tragedy I see here is that the kind of people that have very, very legitimate frustrations, it's really hard to see how massive tax cuts at the top, no changing in fundamental structure of the fiscal side, and no real changes in terms of thinking about it other than trade, it doesn't really add up. And I feel like it's very likely those people are going to be losers again.
Can I ask David a question? I'm curious, David, for your views about the effectiveness of worker training and retraining. Because one of the ways that economists would talk about responding to a trade agreement that makes the pie bigger but hurts some people is to help the people who lost their jobs doing X or Y learn how to do something else. And the U.S. spends, I believe, a lot less on worker training than most European countries do. At the same time, I thought the evidence about worker training in this country was that it was often not very effective.
Most worker training has been really quite ineffective, in fact. And partly it's because it's very short. And most importantly, it's for a long time been what I call disembodied training. It's sort of, we're going to get you a GED. We are actually finding out now that if you link training programs, including, by the way, some, you know, community college, post-secondary work and so forth, with real jobs and real employers, you do much, much better. And so thinking there are strategies like career academies, sometimes called sectoral training programs, we're training you for a specific sector that you're ready for. So I think there is good news in the sense that we're pretty rapidly learning what we can do better. But the truth is we've done a lot of things poorly. And one of the real frustrations that I think everyone should have is, you know, we've been very slow to learn about things that haven't worked. And we've spent a lot of money that wasn't well spent. So I think there are strategies that could help. I don't know, you know, how far is a bigger question. And yet we haven't done those things.
We hear a lot about manufacturing getting outsourced, but that kind of goes against the fact that right now the United States has its highest manufacturing output in history. An interesting thing I read about, I think about a year ago, was that in the United States there are somewhere around 3 to 4 million truck drivers, and in 5 to 10, 15 years, automated trucks are going to put all of them out of work. How much do we need to prepare for a future where people who don't have a college degree, who have relatively little training, simply don't have jobs that are available in this kind of knowledge economy? What do we do for them?
So I think our history suggests that as the sectoral composition of the economy changes, we tend to create jobs for people who want jobs. But the jobs can be quite different, and that's what we need to worry about. So it's possible that there will be no jobs for less skilled people. I don't think that's the main problem, though. I think the main problem is that the jobs that will exist will require different sorts of education or training, and we need to help people get that. And the jobs that will exist will not be for the big company with the pensions and the healthcare benefits, the things that Bridget talked about before. So I think if we focus on helping to train people for different sorts of work in the way that David described, and focus on how to build a system of social insurance that protects people who won't be cocooned in a big company for their whole lives. I think those are the ways to respond to this.
And let me give you actually some counterexamples. You're certainly right about manufacturing, but of course, manufacturing is now full employment for robots.
Exactly. That's part of the problem, isn't it?
But you know, not so many people.
Yeah.
But there are sectors. Think of the personal care sector, where you know the people in the personal care sector take care of our children, our parents, us. And we're going to need more of those people, There's going to be less of them. But right now, they have very low wages. They're virtually invisible. They're not, you know, really treated very well on average. There is no way in which they can move up very readily. It's not easy to go from being a home health aide to working in a nursing home. You'd think that wouldn't be a big step, but it's a really big step in the way it currently is operating. And so I think, and technology is not going to replace them anytime soon. We're really not looking for robots to take care of our kids. And so I think it's a really interesting opportunity, for example, to really take – there are some sectors where it's not – part of it is we can train people for the newer thing. But part of it is I do think we're going to have to rethink the nature of work and the nature of jobs and the nature of compensation for these folks. And what's interesting about this personal care sector, the economics will be working in their favor. But it will take more than that to make it actually work for people, because we will want it to work for people, because we will need people in those settings.
Well, that actually brings us back to something we were talking about before with apps like TaskRabbit and Handy, where you can order personal care on demand, where everything they do is rated by 5 stars, hopefully. And these are people who are technically independent contractors. They don't have benefits classically. How is that going to affect the way – I mean, how do we as a society respond to that?
Yeah, I mean, we're going to have to think about how do we provide the benefits that have traditionally been provided through employers to the growing number of individuals who are – basically self-employed. And is that going to require a fundamental rethinking of the U.S. approach, which is uniquely U.S., to providing health insurance and pensions? In most other countries, health insurance is not something that we have delegated to employers to provide. It's something provided by the federal government. And the U.S. system works well if you have most of your workforce in jobs attached to a large employer who can provide those benefits at economies of scale. But if the economy is changing, we now have to think about, do you want to redesign the whole system? Do you want to come up with a bunch of little patchwork pieces to change things? I was in the UK 3 weeks ago, and the courts there delivered a decision that the Uber drivers are actually employees. Now, that's a decision binding in the UK, doesn't transfer over to the US, but, it might also be the case that the, the laws that say who's an employee and who's not an employee, that we end up changing them. I'm not necessarily advocating for that, but I mean, there are a lot of things that you could see happening, and I mean, this is exactly what you would like thoughtful policymakers. One of the things you would like thoughtful policymakers to be thinking about and doing it proactively rather than reactively. So let's think about solutions that keep us from having a big problem rather than trying to dig ourselves out of a hole 20 years from now because we didn't think about it today.
I think there are actually several lawsuits here in the United States, class action from Uber drivers pushing for much the same. Are there kind of private solutions to these problems that are out there on the table? Obviously, again, I come back to a very conservative White House and Congress and Supreme Court, for that matter, that will likely be looking to the private sector to fill in those gaps. Are there ways that you famously came up with the 401k opt-in, opt-out research? Are there ways that we can push people to make the right decisions without, creating a social system to support it?
So I think there are ways to do it on the savings side, and technology really helps there. So the gig economy jobs that are fundamentally tied to technology. The great thing about that is the payment mechanisms are all electronic, and so it wouldn't be that hard to think of a way to help those individuals save for retirement through something that looks like a 401k plan. There would be some work to make it happen. There would be a few regulatory changes that could make it easier. I think it's much more difficult to think about it on the health insurance side. So if you think about savings, one of the features that some people have pointed to the gig economy is it allows individuals to be very flexible in terms of how much they want to work. And you've got some people who are working 3 or 4 different jobs, so I can, run my Airbnb in my apartment, and I can drive some Uber, and I can do some task rabbiting, and I can, make a job that works for me. And on the savings side, it's really easy to add that up, right? I can save a little bit in job A, a little bit in job B, and we add it all up, and I could do okay in theory. Much more difficult to think about how you would do that on the health insurance side, where health insurance is not a commodity that you scale up or scale down in the same way that you can do with savings. Like, having 3 lousy minimal health insurance policies from 3 different, jobs is not really the right approach, and it's much more difficult to aggregate. So I think that's a bigger challenge. And then, of course, things like parental leave and sick leave and things like that, those are really valuable benefits for certain segments of the workforce. One outcome could be that the people who are working in the gig economy end up being the people who don't place a high value on those benefits, and so the fact that they're not getting them doesn't matter so much. But I think that's something else that is worth thinking about.
Can I pick up on Bridget's point about the healthcare? Because I think one of the unfortunate aspects of the very heated but not very well lit debate about the Affordable Care Act has been a denigration of the private insurance exchanges. Because if one is trying to set up a system whereby people who have a set of jobs can end up with one entire health insurance package, and one wants to use the private sector to do that, well, that's what health insurance marketplaces can do. They're a place where people come to buy private health insurance. So it is essentially relying on the private sector for the health insurance. But you need, because health insurance has these features that Bridget described, you can't add up a bunch of little policies to get to a good one. Also because people end up with pre-existing conditions, and then insurers are, from their perspective, sensibly not interested in offering them insurance at low rates, you need to have some structure around the market. You can't make it just like any other sort of market for any other sort of good. So I think insurance marketplaces where people can come and buy health insurance are, in my view, an important part of how we can address the health insurance needs of people in this economy where big companies aren't playing such an important role. We need to figure out some way that satisfies both Democrats and Republicans about the structure of benefits that's required, whether there should be a mandate and so on. But I think the idea of a private marketplace with some government oversight is the way to go.
Yeah, but the problem is always selection, right? I mean, employers, there's huge variation in how much health care you're going to need in a year, and right. Some of that's predictable. And so insurance companies, there's 2 ways to make money, is right. One way is to create a good product, another is to have good people to insure. And it's really hard, and part of what's happened with the ACA is some of the low-risk, low-cost people haven't signed up, and so insurers have been left with higher-cost folks, so they've had to raise their premiums because they don't have the cheaper people they expected. Mm-hmm. But I'm interested for you, both of you, another proposal that often comes up is health savings accounts. Is that real? Is that helpful, or is that a gimmick? Does this solve these problems in the way, or is this just like, wait, health insurance isn't the same?
And can you define what a health savings account is?
Maybe I should ask David what he has in mind with health savings account.
Ask Donald Trump. It's one of his solutions to replace the ACA.
I mean, under current law, you can only have a health savings account if it's combined with a high deductible health insurance plan. They're like Jack and Jill. They go together. So the health savings account, you would have to change the law to allow for a health savings account in the absence of a high deductible health plan. I think that's a legal regulatory challenge you can solve. The bigger challenge is how do you get people to save in these plans? So I've been studying savings for years. You know, we have ways to get people to save, but I'll come back to what I said earlier was, you know, we know how to get people to save for retirement, and we still have half of the workforce that is not participating in an employer-sponsored retirement savings plan. For a health savings account, you know, the system is not going to, if we're relying on individuals to do this on their own, the system is not going to work if you have numbers that look like what's happening on the retirement savings side. You'll have, you know, some higher income or, you know, very patient, good saver, you know, good savers who, you know, are able to drive Uber by day and get health insurance by night for their families. But you'll have a large number of people who don't, and then they become, it's not that these people aren't going to get sick. Mm-hmm. It's just that when they get sick, they will neither have health insurance nor that, nor will they have savings, and then they become uncompensated care.
Well, plus, the amount of, given how high certain medical, you know, if you get really sick, it's really expensive. It seems hard to see how you do this without some sort of insurance combined with it, just as you said originally.
Right. Could it possibly be cost neutral? The people who aren't actually insured, they're eventually going to be going to hospitals. And I think the ACA was supposed to be designed to try and reap some savings there.
Well, I think the first thing I'd say about health savings accounts is that it is economists have correctly, I think, over the years encouraged changes in tax subsidies for health insurance that would lead people to pay a little more out of pocket and have a little less covered by insurance. Because if you pay out of pocket, you're a little more sensitive to the cost of procedures, and there's some things that are optional that you might choose not to do. But as David says, that's not where most of the money is. Most of the money in healthcare goes to people who are quite sick, for whom there is maybe uncertainty on the part of the doctor or the patient as to what should be done for medical reasons. But it's not sort of optional in a financial sense. Mm-hmm. And in fact, in the Affordable Care Act, the more minimal plans that are available in the exchanges have much larger deductibles and copayments than the health insurance that most other Americans have. Mm-hmm. So in fact, I think we've gone in this direction, and I think that's useful, but I don't think that a further leap toward having everybody somehow save for their own health care really works for the reasons that we've talked about. People who get very sick are going to need a lot more care, and we'll have a lot more money spent on them than people who don't. And that's going to require some pooling of risks through insurance. I think as far as saving money in the healthcare system, there are probably lots of ways that we can save money, and lots of hospitals and physicians and insurers are working on ways to save money. But it's a difficult thing for the government to force at a particular pace. They can do that to some extent through changing the payment system in Medicare, which is the single largest payer for healthcare in the country. And there are a lot of parts of the Affordable Care Act, some parts put in place and some experiments undertaken under the act that are meant to try to encourage providers to provide care that is more effective, of higher value, not just and pay for the value, for the effectiveness, not just paying for more services being delivered. Mm-hmm. But it's hard to rush that along because we don't know at a very specific level what we should do and not do and how you pay for health care. And other part of this is that Americans like the idea that if they get sick, they and their doctor can choose to throw everything at it. And that's going to tend to make this expensive. There was a recent paper by some people we know looking at veterinary care in the United States, which it turns out is growing very rapidly over time. And the analogy was made that the point was made that this is not subsidized by the government, it's not generally insured, but Americans think if their pets are, Americans who can afford it, who think when their pets are sick, they want to throw everything health that modern medicine can bring to bear. So part of the underlying challenge here is that we as a culture do a lot of pretty ambitious things for people who are quite sick, and that is expensive given what we pay doctors. Given what we pay other people who work in the healthcare sector. Mm-hmm. So I think there are ways to get a lot better, but it's not that there's a sort of obvious set of policies on the shelf that could be put in place.
And it's expensive
tomorrow.
Because if if there's a, if people are willing to pay a lot for something, there's always going to be somebody trying to fill that market with new technology and new things that right. make a small difference at the margin. But, you know, small difference when you're facing something horrible is, you know,
a big difference.
1% chance of living longer is a big deal.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think it would be really interesting to see what a Republican president and a Republican Congress, how they grapple with these issues, because one effective way or potentially effective way to save costs is to reduce choice and send people to less expensive hospitals.
Death
less
panels, I believe is how.
Less expensive doctors, you know,
yes.
to but mm-hmm. the Republicans historically have been very opposed to anything that looks like restricting free choice.
Mm-hmm. Except for poor people. To be fair, Medicaid is perfectly okay to do that.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, they're kind of two different ideologies within the party that are going to knock heads with the desire to cut public spending. Mm-hmm.
So we're running out of time here, but I wanted to ask one last question just open to all of you. With the Trump administration coming in, do you see low-hanging fruit that we might see some progress on the, you know, core issue of inequality in our country? And, you know, perhaps there are things that Democrats wanted to pass, but it just was politically unfeasible for Republicans to support a Democratic proposal. Do you have hope for what might happen?
You know, look, infrastructure stuff is what's being talked about. I think that's a good thing. I mean, what's interesting is it's, of course, precisely what Obama wanted to do, and the Republicans didn't want to do because it was expensive, but fine, whatever. And I think the Democrats, some Democrats and some Republicans might team up to pass something that some of both sides are struggling with. I think there are a number of things like that. Doug would be much more of an expert.
Well, I think it's a very positive sign that many people on the Republican side and the conservative side are focused on increasing economic opportunity. And that is an issue, as David said, that really now a level of concern cuts across the political spectrum. Of course, the harder part is agreeing on steps one might take. I'm hopeful here that we will spend less time in the next few years arguing just over budget numbers and arguing about whether certain things can be cut or not, and spend more time thinking about innovative ways to help people. And if we can get a little bit out of what I view now as a pretty sterile debate about just sort of cutting benefits and focus more on how to build avenues for economic opportunity, as David says, I think that will be much more constructive, and I think there's some chance that that will happen.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to thank you all again for joining us for this discussion. I think it was really fascinating. Dean Douglas Elmendorf, Professor Bridget Madrian, and Professor David Elwood, thanks for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Special thanks once again for HKS Magazine's editor, Robert O'Neill, for his instrumental role in making this series roundtables happen. You can find excerpts from this interview and others in the upcoming winter issue. You can also find all of our episodes of PolicyCast on Medium, so check it out at hkspolicycast.org. HKS PolicyCast is a production of Harvard Kennedy School. I'm your host, Matt Cadwallader. Natalie Montaner is our guest wrangler. Sarah Abrams, our sage advisor. And Becky Wickle, our deft digital deliberator. Send us your comments and questions to policycast@hks.harvard.edu or on Twitter @policycast. See you next week.